PPI.org.
It's Friday. That means it's time for Catalyst, your weekly show of politics and culture. I'm Lydia Howe.
And I am Rico Morales.
And we're talking about how to grow food and create a more resilient economy with Just Food and Water activist Marita Bujold. Plus,
we're going to hear from Misha Bartlett about the entertainment and food service and other industries that are struggling and people that are coming together for mutual aid, bringing hope back into the community.
We're going to get started with a little bit of a tribute to the folks that grow your food. And for those who think they don't like immigrants, well, then maybe you should stop eating, as this beautiful song will show you how much you rely on immigrant migrant workers.
Up from El Centro and San Bernardino, bakers feel Fresno, Madera, Merced, Salinas and Stockton, up to Sacramento, Santa Rosa and Red Bluff, and on back again. 100,000 men, women and children flow on the highway, the young and the old, an unending cycle of sowing and reaping. The long valley's labor can never be done. And see how the land yields up her treasures to a man's patient hands. Up in the morning, an hour before dawning, stretching and yawning, rubbing sleep from their eyes, with the last star still quivering and the morning breeze shivering, the sun is just lighting the easternmost skies. Soon in the big open trucks they will travel, crowded together and crammed in like cattle, over pavement, over gravel, over dirt roll the wheels, out to the orchards, the vineyards, the fields. And see how the land yields up her treasures to man's patient hands. Soon in the long rows the swift hands are toiling, the day's growing heat and the dusty rose boiling. The sun presses down like a hot, heavy hand on the backs of the laborers that are working the land. In the shade of the oak trees by the side of the field rows, dirty and shoeless, the young children play, while fathers and mothers, older sisters and brothers, toil on the knees in the heat of the day. And see how the land yields up her treasures to man's patient hands. Down from the highway come men in brown uniform, questioning, checking and searching, and soon one or two whose papers are not in order will be gone from the crew in the hot afternoon. But when the sun is descended and the long day is ended, it's back to the trucks wiping sweat from their eyes, tired and weary and covered all over with fruit juice and brown dust and sweat and black flies. And see how the land yields up her treasures to man's patient hands. When there's crops in the fields and there's grapes in the vineyards, the limbs of the orchards bow low to the ground, There's food on the table and clothes for the children, and singing and dancing and joy all around. But with the skies grey as iron and the icy winds whistling, frost in the fields and the work to be found, in the cold night they huddle, with hunger they struggle, till spring brings back sweetness and life to the ground. And see how the land yields up her treasures to man's patient hands. And see how the land yields up her treasures to a man's patient hands.
And that was Peter Krug, The Migrant Song, off of Best of the Broadsides, a beautiful collection, 5-CD set, put up by Smithsonian Folkways. It's like the soundtrack of social justice from the late 50s through the early 80s.
Well, as migrants and as a migrant family in Minnesota and Wisconsin here all my life, ever since I was born and able to walk, I've been working in the fields as a migrant worker, working on the farm. And it's not a very easy job. It's a very difficult work, and milking cows and cleaning chickens and building the pig barns and cleaning off the pigs. And, you know, it's just, there's just so much work and care and actual, you know, concern, mindfulness for the earth and for the harvest. It's very important. That's why we celebrate the harvest, you know, in the autumn. So it's really good to talk about the food and the water and the justice and the food and water sustainability in local and global ways.
Which we're going to do with Marita Bujold of Just Food and Water. Welcome to KFEI, Marita.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So the sort of overarching reason that you're coming in today is that there's a bill at the State House, Headwaters Community Food and Water Economic Resiliency Program, HF 2738, which I'll repeat later. And it has a lot of moving parts, but I thought we could start with, there's this recognition that we have an unsustainable economy, an unsustainable food economy. And so part of the goal of this bill is working towards a more resilient economy. How would a resilient economy be different than the one we're in now?
Well, really from source to table, what we all depend on right now, the industrial food chain, is unsustainable in its practices, at every level, and the costs of it are unsustainable as well. So the purpose of this bill, which creates an economic resiliency program, is to actually shape an economy that we really need and to build off of what we know actually will help us be resilient, and that is the local ecological knowledge and skills that have been developed really over thousands of years in locations all over the world by indigenous communities. Small-scale operations have always been the key to having the kind of sustainable systems that we need. But what we've done in the past decades is actually fueled an industrial system which is completely counter to that sustainability mode that really these small-scale communities have done and continue to do in locations all over the world, that help them be adapted to the place that they live, care for those ecosystems in which they live, and generate amazing diversity of food and knowledge and skills. All of that is still present and available to us, but what we haven't done is actually supported those systems. We've done the reverse.
Well, this sort of industrial system. This industrial system, which I think, you know, factory farming, I think, tells you everything you need to know. We've tried to turn the planet into a factory. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you just look at this recent thing with the meatpacking plants. And I saw a thing on mainstream TV news, and it was just sort of horrifying. This and how it's all breaking down right now because of the virus. But what you're saying is, see, I think we all grew up with this idea that so-called developing countries were starving and that this industrial farming modality was going to feed the planet. That's what we were told. And what you're saying is that's a big lie because people have been feeding themselves with this indigenous models. Am I understanding?
Yes. In fact, that false narrative that has been promoted by the industrial system really has prevented us from understanding who does feed the world. And even today, 70% of the world's people are fed by small-scale farmers or fisher folk or pastoralists who still operate in an ecologically sound way. And if we supported them, if our public dollars were actually dedicated to supporting those communities around the world and here in our own communities, building off of local knowledge, we would actually be able to manage all of these systems and capture carbon, feed the people as we need to, and we'd build this foundation for long term. It's like we took a wrong turn when we started to support these industrial systems and really set us on a course for failure. And what we need to do is actually fund with our public treasury a system that's going to help us live sustainably. And it's entirely possible.
How much money, mm-hmm. how much money, do you know how much public money, at least in Minnesota, if not nationally, goes into agriculture?
I couldn't tell you what happens in Minnesota specifically, but I do know that every year, this industrial food chain costs us around the world $12 trillion, and that includes the costs of the foods themselves, in addition to all the ecological and healthcare costs that the public pays for because this system is unsustainable. So that means that we're having to pay for things like water that's been contaminated, for healthcare costs that are actually created by foods that are part of this system that are of really questionable value. We have, you know, there are literally hundreds and hundreds of preservatives that go into processed foods. And processed foods are the hallmark of our industrial system, which is so contrary to what, you know, perhaps our grandmothers, great-grandmothers, who cooked real food in our kitchens, and it came from often from gardens that they had in their own backyards or within their communities. We're in a position where we really cannot continue to do this, and there's a real opportunity here, especially now, is like you're referencing this processed meat packing industry. It's really exposing so clearly what we've known for a long time, and that this approach to meat production and processing is an incubator for disease.
So, Marita, I am Rico Morales here, and I'm just going to ask you a question. If this global food system is not sustainable, I would, some people would say, well, it's working, and it's been what's worked for dozens of years or decades even. It's the system, and it's been successful.
Well, it's successful at what it's designed to do, which is to, A, dominate the food system. So it, we actually, you know, this all comes out of Washington, D.C., and the people who work with the USDA and for the USDA create policies that actually advance the success of the industrial food chain. And then they have access to the public treasury to support it. In addition, trade arrangements are made so that these vast quantities of commodity crops that are grown have a place to go. So they've had the control really over what happens with our food and our food system. And they would argue that it is successful in what it's intended to do.
But it's not like this is that long. We haven't had this exist that long. My understanding is the industrial food system, as we know it, dates from around the World War II era, maybe slightly before that. But this is—it's not like this is the only way to get food. There were other practices before and during, And there are still people, even in this country, trying to practice a different agriculture.
Community-supported agricultures.
Right,
small
community
farms.
Yeah, which has been around for, you know, at least since the 70s that I know of. It would be, I will try to figure out if I can find out what the Minnesota part of that $12 trillion is. I mean, I know you're looking at it in a much bigger way in terms of health costs and environmental cleanup costs, et cetera. But the inclusivity piece, I think, is really important. I mean, that the pandemic has really been exposing stuff that some of us already knew was there, but it's exposing it all in a very stark way. And for us to know that if you don't include everybody in the start and you're not deliberate, it don't happen. What are some of the ideas in this bill that would mean that it's not just going to, that people won't be excluded? You know, I'm thinking communities of color, immigrant communities with their own food cultures, people on the res, Native American people.
Mm-hmm.
How is inclusivity kind of built into the Headwaters Community Food and Water Economic Resiliency Program?
Well, it's really critical that we first understand that there's already leadership in our communities. Often it is communities of color, our Native communities, who are already looking at how do we be more resilient? How can we have a food system even within our own neighborhoods and communities that will serve us, because they've already recognized that the system that we have doesn't provide them with affordable and healthy food. And they're also looking to their own history and saying, you know, what we did have, as you both mentioned, prior to the industrial system was actually good for us. The various foods that were brought here by the Africans who were forced to come to this country as slaves, still, I mean, these were foods and skills that actually were valued at the time because people who forced them to come here recognized these people know things. And yet, so much of that has been diverted or lost along the way because we've been put in a position of depending on this other system. So what this bill does is it creates a regenerative food web economy that is decentralized and builds our capacity for every community to be connected within that web from source to table to grow the food that we need, to bring it into our communities to be preserved, to be cooked, to be served right in our own neighborhoods. So what it does is it creates opportunities for people at every part of that economic system to participate and benefit. So if you're a young person growing up in North Minneapolis and you're part of their effort, for instance, to learn about growing food, and they've been doing this for a number of years now, you might decide, I really want to be part of this web as a grower. This would help that individual and their friends and colleagues who want to be part of that to access land, to be part of this system, to be the growers. There might be another young person that says, I really want to be the person that cooks the food that's here in my neighborhood, that's going to bring communities together around a table. And this system, this regenerative food web, is designed so that they become a member in that web economy, so that now they're employed, they're valued in a way that really we haven't valued these professions, the people who grow our food, the people who cook it, the people who preserve it. A lot of that's been done very remotely and on the backs of labor especially, that has been underpaid and often even in circumstances that are completely unlivable, as the song that you played reminded us.
So, well, and also, I don't want to, you know, we're living in this time now. I think where people are beginning to notice, you know, as beloved restaurants close, as mm-hmm. the workers that, you know, delivered food, grew food, deliver it, cook it, serve it, you know, as all of that is in trouble. You know, Rico, you were mentioning you're growing up in migrant farm families, family. And then I also know that you and I share that we've worked in different community gardens.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What would you bring into this conversation about the localism, as one of the things I got out of what Marita was saying, that mm-hmm. rather than our food being sent to us from hundreds of miles away, we would end up more of it, maybe not all of it, more of it would be grown here. I mean, jump in.
I think it's definitely a huge conversation topic, specifically with the city governance and the county governance and the state regulations of the community gardens or of local neighborhood organizations. We have to go through certain steps. You have to go through and fill out a form. You have to contact the city. You have to do this, do this, do this, do this, do that. Then some more hoops. And then there's also the people always want to question you or me, where are we going to get the money? What's the funding? You know, so it's a very white-centric way of doing things sometimes in Minneapolis, Minnesota, of course. But it's also, you know, an encouragement for me to just go out and not dig into the yard, but have a self-contained bins or boxes and just grow food that's almost like mobile. Like you don't have to grow into the ground because of the TCE and the arsenic triangle that is in East Phillips. But, you know, you can subvert that by growing indoors or growing in pots or growing in bins and boxes that are self-contained with proper remediants. So that it's an encouraging thing, because when I've been involved in these community gardens, there's always these questions and these people who are sitting around. Mostly, generally, it's a group of white people talking about how to grow indigenous food.
Well, and how much of it is based on this whole profit model rather than thinking about community sustainability?
Yeah.
And that part of a community being sustainable is we can all eat. It's kind of basic human thing. Marita, I am assuming that we're talking very different agricultural practice, because included in this, and I love that pragmatism is part of this bill, but it's defined as this recognition of an interdependence between human beings and our ecology, our environment. So what happens to big ag? I mean, it is like the diametrical opposite of a recognition of interdependence. It's that industrial food system. How does this Headwaters Community Food and Water Economic Resiliency Program address the ecology? And like what Rico was saying, I think is so beautiful that the inventiveness is saying, okay, you've poisoned our land. We're going to grow in
boxes.
In boxes.
Boxes and bins and mm-hmm. pots.
Well, yes, and it's actually what Rico's describing is an experience that immigrants' families have all over the world. If you look at our urban agriculture, it actually feeds about 15% of the world's food. And the reason that happens is because as we see migrants move to various parts of the world, what they bring with them are their foods, their seeds, their plants, and the skills that they had in their previous locations. Often they're being forced to move, and yet this is so valuable to them, they bring it with them, and they will do whatever they can to grow their own food for two reasons. One, because it's of value to them, and two, because we know worldwide they cannot afford grocery store food. So they are motivated to actually grow whatever, find whatever land they can. So that's one part of the answer to this question. Why is this bill written to acknowledge a timeless truth, that truth being that we have this interdependent relationship between people and nature? Because as we have seen, when we subvert that truth, when we ignore it, what we end up with is a system designed to, with byproducts that are things like contaminated water systems and soil, meat processing processing systems that are unsustainable. All of the industrial system, every element of it is designed to make us dependent on them. And it ignores the relationship between healthy ecosystems and people as the key to being and living sustainably. This is what indigenous peoples always knew. Wherever they lived, they figured out how to actually adapt to that particular place and understand what the ecosystem had to offer them, and then either generate food by cultivating it or harvesting what was wild, what is wild, and being able to keep that as part of their diet. That has always been the key to how people have lived on the planet. What we've done with this industrial system is moved entirely away from that. And we're in a position now where we can no longer ignore the impact of that system, not only because we can't rely on it for food, but also because the industrial system is a major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, hopefully, is there anything in here for land reclamation? I'm thinking both mm-hmm. from what Rico was saying about poison lands, but also thinking about, which is more like from our usual thought process of industry, you know, but also how big ag destroys land and water, too. Is there an element of this bill that reclaims land that then can be farmed by new people, you know, doing small farming, resilience farming?
There is. In fact, one of the key elements of this is really to look at the position we're in right now. And the last 10, 15 years, there's been a lot of talk about how the farmers in the system, the conventional farmers, are at an age now where most of them are either ready to retire or will be very soon. And then the question is, what happens to all those acres that are dedicated to conventional farming? What is it that's going to happen next? So this bill provides resources to help those conventional farmers move out of that system, and they have options to either be selling their land to people who will be regenerative,
and then
doing regenerative systems, or choose to do as one farmer I met recently, actually be part of a regenerative system himself and convert that land. And the good news is that once that decision is made and people leave that system, stop planting these conventional crops and using these chemicals that are damaging to the soil, you begin to see the health of the ecosystem revive fairly quickly. It's really remarkable what can happen.
That's why the Farmers' Almanac and all the farmers, usually what they used to do is let their land rest every 7 years.
Mm. Well, and some of it even more often than that a field would be fallow 1 year and planted the next, or planted with something, a different crop that would regenerate the soil, like legumes.
Yeah.
Instead of something that took more from the soil,
we're
going to get our lentils or our peas or whatever, but that'll also put something back.
The three sisters model.
Okay.
Exactly.
The corn, the beans, and I can't remember.
Squash.
Squash, thank you.
Squash. Yes, which will grow anywhere.
Yeah.
It'll take over
it
your world.
It will take over. It will.
Well, this is very encouraging.
What's the number of that bill again? The HF?
2738.
HF. Mm-hmm. And it's coming up soon, or?
The bill was introduced last year, and then we were hoping to get a committee hearing this year. Unfortunately, we did not. We did, however, get a few folks to actually come on board, some legislators to come on board from the Jobs and Economic Development Committee, where it would have been heard. But at this point, right now, what's happening with the bill is that there's a lot of talk. So people are saying, well, what's this really about? Why do we need to have an economic resiliency program for the state of Minnesota to be successful?
Well, and I think
what
now
would it do for us?
There is no more right now. Like right now, it's kind of obvious. They might have been asking that 2 months ago, but I think right now, May 15th, 2020, these questions are answering themselves. I want to say, too, Rico and I's Minnesota State Rep, Jim Davney, is a new co-sponsor, and that's pretty exciting. And we so appreciate you coming on, Marita, because even though nothing is happening at the State House, what is happening is more and more people in the community knowing about this and helping to make something happen. That bill number again is HF 2738, and it's the Headwaters Community Food and Water Economic Resiliency Program. People should check out your website, justfoodandwater.org, justfoodandwater.org. This has been a wonderful and inspiring conversation, and when I leave the station, I'm doing nothing but gardening, so...
Today's a beautiful day for it.
It's perfect, perfect day for it. Unfortunately, I can't grow too much food except for collard greens, which will grow anywhere. Well, potatoes, yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah.
I don't have any sun, so it's a constant challenge. Basil. Basil and collard greens seem to grow. Thank you so much for coming on Catalyst, and stay in touch, and when as things progress, we'll have you back.
Thank you very much.
And before we have this wonderful conversation with Misha Bartlett around sustaining your local artists, I thought it'd be fun to hear some. I've been wanting to play this poem for several weeks now. This is yet another piece off the wonderful CD, Nation of Immigrants, produced by our local literary center, The Loft. And this is by Diego Vasquez Jr., and it's a poem for my uncle, Que Puas Vato.
A man say goodbye to his wife of 49 years as she lay made up, peaceful, and no longer tired. She looks beautiful again, as if still breathing, and he stands to touch her hand. He has returned to her 12 times before the lid will be closed at the end of the viewing. Well, This man is your uncle, un veterano with a wooden leg, from the 101st, de la Guerra Segunda, airborne, with the Screaming Eagle stenciled on the driveway. Yes, this same man would drive you and your cousins on Sunday morning paper routes in his white 59 Chevy Biscayne. A 3-speed on the column, which only on Sunday he would drive with a cane instead of wearing that hard leg for the dawn of those heavy paper mornings. And this vato was the grandest piano player we knew. He, many times, telling us stories of early pre-war nights and today, playing los clubs in La Frontera between El Paso y Juaritos, of all the weddings he had played. We only guessed about the women. He was the proudest husband ever of the best woman anywhere, the most gentle, and the only man from whom I cannot remember having heard an unkind word, even after a botched runaway in my teens, using his Southern Pacific Rail Pass for a free ride to the Angels Town, which he never got mean about, just disappointed. Well, this uncle wonderful of mine, as I see him walking in his crooked way to my aunt's side to whisper his goodbyes, I recall warm, quiet lights from their bedroom, and years before, when they lost their only little girl to a terrible mistake in a huge swimming pool. I still hear him convincing all of the children God would deliver blessings, and my uncle would make sure of it by saying in the softest voice of a great piano man, "Mijo, God's will bless you." And as we sit and watch this giant of peace who can no longer drink his whiskey, who has chosen not to talk much nor to use his memory, we see him recognizing his beautiful wife has gone. And we hear my uncle mumble that he wishes he could cry, but it does not come. And 12 times we watch him say goodbye.
Diego Vasquez Jr. from St. Paul, from the Loft Project, Nation of Immigrants. And that's a poem for his uncle at his aunt's funeral. And it's just so many beautiful images and memories all in that one poem.
Yeah, I almost cried.
Yeah.
It was so wonderful and pertinent to all these conversations that we're having. I'm Rico Morales. Buenas tardes, todo gente. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to be speaking with Misha Bartlett, event, concert, and creative content producer. She is also a celebrity makeup artist and stylist here in the Twin Cities. Her jobs and employment and situations are very pertinent to what's going on and happening in the country and around the world right now. Good afternoon, Misha.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you, my friends?
We're doing really well. And could you tell us what's happening with the event, concert, and creative content production world and the celebrity makeup artist and stylist world in the Twin Cities here, because of the different selections of the salons and the barbershops and the different laws and rules that are passed and different openings and close downs? How is that affecting you?
Well, gosh, that's quite an introduction. It sounds like I should be really busy right now, all those hats that I wear. And yet, completely dead in the water on most things. So that's obviously a lot to chew on, a big discussion. And I do want to say before we get started on our conversation, what a great thing. I love to hear the conversation you were just having. I'm so vested in what's going on in the future of farming and just, food supply. And so I think it's really great that there are things present right now in legislature that will hopefully make some really great changes. So just thank you to the gal that was just on. Sorry, I don't know her name.
Marita Buchholz.
For her efforts there.
Yeah, Marita Buchholz.
Thank you, Marita, because I think she's doing great things, and I'm super excited about that. So, we are obviously still in very unprecedented times. And even as we're looking at a restart, a small, slow restart of certain things in the economy, we're still looking at a very uncertain and unusual picture. You know, how do we get back together and even consider being able to go to a restaurant right now, let alone a live music venue? You know, we are in a time where we can barely go to shop for food and groceries and some essentials without needing to really be distanced. And so the idea of being elbow to elbow or shoulder to shoulder with your stylist, with your makeup artist, whoever that might be, we're sort of kind of creating, I think, on the fly new ways and new procedures in how we're going to do that.
So do you think that, I know that things are not going to go back exactly to the way they were. I think that's just too much to even imagine right now, given that we don't have a vaccine or treatments yet for COVID-19. But as a small business person and as a person that's obviously working in a lot of different areas, I don't want to sound impatient, but I'm kind of like, are we not willing to at least make some changes, like require masks when you go into a business, or say only so many people at a time allowed in? I mean, are we not allowed to do some basic public health measures so that a stylist could reopen their shop, so an art gallery could have people come look? Live music, well, when it's warm, it seems like outside would be a way that would be more likely to have be able to see, you know, live music. But I mean, what is the feeling you're getting from people? Are folks willing to do basic public health measures as we do this reopening?
I think they are. I think the struggle has been so great. I think the imminent threat, and it's really imminent, of, you know, many, many people on a daily basis completely losing their livelihoods, like these things they've worked for years to build, businesses that they've put their heart, soul, money, their whole lives into. I think that people will be willing to acquiesce to whatever it is to be able to just sort of get back in, roll up their sleeves, and do it in a safe and responsible manner. I don't think there's really going to be a choice. There's been a very slow sort of distribution of funds as it comes with the PPE and the SBA loans. So we're really at a crisis level for a lot of, especially our small business here locally, and independent contractors, people being able to continue doing what they do. So, yeah, I mean, those are great thoughts. I think, yes, absolutely, people are going to be willing to do whatever it takes at this point to get back in there. I mean, I know, you know, I myself and many of my friends, I mean, there's nothing we would love more than just to be able to go see our favorite stylist, grab a haircut, get that massage, that therapy that we need, that there's something about the personal touch and the personal interaction in that particular industry, that service industry, that is so special. And I think people are really, really craving it at this point. So I think they're going to be willing to do whatever it takes to do that safely and effectively. I was reading a couple really great articles over the last couple weeks about specifically the entertainment industry and what's going on with the NIVA, the National Independent Venue Association. This collaboration of promoters, you know, music representatives, venues that have come together for the first time really in history, right, because they're normally competitors, to seek targeted federal attention and relief. And I thought there was this really profound part of that article that talked about the Roaring Twenties. After the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918, the 20s roared in, and it was because of that sort of starvation of social interaction and economy that created this boon after that pandemic. And it's really kind of the last time we've seen something on this level, right, in a global scale. And so I'm really hopeful. I'm hopeful. I am confident in humanity. I am all about doing whatever it takes to get back to some sense of normalcy. And I know it's going to be not normal for a very long time, but I'm really hopeful that if we do this in the right way, we're going to be able to reestablish that. I have a six-year-old daughter, a beautiful little girl, and it would just crush me to think that she couldn't experience this beautiful life I've been able to experience in a similar fashion. So I'll do whatever I can to make that possible.
So, Misha, you've been a part of some of the Minnesota Voices United and some of that collaboration. Can you tell us a little bit about Never Give Up and bringing hope back into the situation?
Absolutely. My roots in the music community here are deep and varied for the last, 23 years. And I've been really blessed and honored to be able to be involved in some great collaborations. Minnesota is such a deep well of talent and community as it regards the music industry. And a few years ago when we were dealing with some of the hurricane tragedy going on throughout the world that just kept coming, we put together a collaborative effort and we created a beautiful concert. And subsequently, a song was written by some local luminaries and performed by some big Minnesota talent. And I think the message is eternal. I think it's really, really relevant right now. And so Never Give Up is a song that was written by Julius Collins, Tommy Barbarella, and John Fields. And the voices that you will hear on this song, again, are Julius Collins, Jamecia Bennett,
T. Michael
Kat
Rambo.
Perkins, T. Michael Rambo.
And
yes,
Michael
Kat Perkins and Jesse Larson from The Voice. Yeah.
And then we'll be right back with Misha Bartlett right here after Minnesota Voices United, Never Give Up. We'll be right back after this song.
When life is in question, what are we to do? And there's so many people hopeless, no shelter and no food. So we've got to think that no good comes from doubt. To hear people sing is a beautiful thing. Then goodwill comes about.
When we come together, hand in hand, it's true. We got to care for those in need of us. There's so much work to do. Never give up. Never give up.
great, right? What an anthem. What a message for right now.
It's a beautiful anthem. So as our time is starting to run out, what is it you're hoping people can do to support local artists in this time, given that things aren't, we're not in the what we were in before. So what are you asking people to do to support the local artists they love?
It's a good question. And, you know, I'm looking at numbers and statistics and just my news feed all the time on social media, because it's just flooded with these artists that are trying to keep busy, trying to keep the spirit of creativity alive. And I think some really beautiful, incredible things are going to come out of this, right? Like, artistry sometimes can come from a really dark place or times of pressure and struggle. Like, pressure makes diamonds. And I think there's going to be some really beautiful things that come of this. And I've already seen a flooding of that onto our social media. So my best advice or, you know, wish would be that people continue to support whoever it is that is in your network that is producing art, doing those online concerts, you know, give to their tip jar. Continue to watch, engage, support them, give your commentary, let them know they're being heard, because we don't know when it is we're actually going to be able to all get together and support the artists, support the venues, and all of these other things. So for now, this virtual world we're living in is really, really important. It's vital. And so, I mean, I guess that would just be, you know, what I would ask of others. It's what I'm trying to do myself. I have a few regular things that happen on a weekly basis that, in lieu of being able to be there in the flesh, it's never the same, but it's really, really nice to be able to stay connected and thank God for technology right now. And
well, has anybody created a website or a clearinghouse of local concerts online or other performances online?
I think Springboard for the Arts has definitely collaborated and done a lot of online events. And the Minnesota Music Coalition with Ellen Stanley.
So,
lots of different ways to support. And support KFAI, Fresh Air Community Radio.
Yes.
Support KFAI.
I guess I also want to encourage people. I'm going to sound like a broken record, but I just want to see people be willing to practice wearing a mask and being mindful of not being right on top of other people. The latest reopen date is June 1st, I believe. And if you're going to go get your hair cut, wear a mask until the points where you can't, and then hold it up to your nose and mouth. You know, I'm sure your stylist will be wearing a mask, but practice social distancing. Let's get in that habit so that more of the things we love can reopen safely.
Hey, thank you very much, Misha Bartlett, for contacting us and staying involved. How do people find that music?
So it's unfortunate I don't have a download address for you right now, but we're working on that. So look for that maybe in a future conversation. But presently, you can find me on social media. Facebook has sort of become my medium, my favorite medium right now. You can find me on Facebook at Misha Bartlett or Moxie Talk, Moxxy Talk. And I will certainly keep you abreast of when you can download Never Give Up. It will certainly support local community arts and music scenes. So we would really appreciate that.
Thank you very much, Misha Bartlett. Have a great afternoon.
Thanks for having me. Enjoy.
Yeah. And again, the Minnesota Music Coalition and also Springboard for the Arts are both great options for you to be able to find local concerts. Also want to, you know, remind people of KFAI.org and that many KFAI programs, including this one, Catalyst, can be found on Facebook. It's a KFAI show, Catalyst. If you check out there, you can see part of the testimony given by Dr. Rip Bright, the whistleblower. You can also hear a wonderful performance of the Migrant Strike song, El Picket Line, which we didn't have time for, but it's posted on that page, KFEI show, Catalyst. I just, want to say to people that how this reopen goes depends on us. We don't have to go crazy like they did in Wisconsin, shoehorning themselves into a bar with like one person in the entire place wearing a mask. We can do better. We're Minnesotans. It's really our responsibility. It's really up to us. Thank you so much for listening to Kalisha. We show politics and culture. Peace out.